This is the Kernel MiniConf, the first, hopefully, of many that I won't be organizing anymore. step up. But we decided last year, myself and Willie, we came to LCA, a few people were here, and we just sort of looked around at the MiniConfs and noticed a lot of Kernel people just wandering around. But, you know, nice buildings, nice things to do, but no one knew where to go, no talks, nothing was happening. So we just said we'd try and do something this year, at least get some people into a room. And then we saw the numbers of people that were interested and went, oh, that was a bad idea. Very bad idea. So we left it to the last minute, as per usual, with us Kernel folks. It's, you know, quickly threw it together in about 2 weeks. So today we've got all together, I think we've got six slots to fill. The first slot, Peter Chubb's going to do a kernel development tools, sort of, you know, introductory thing about different types of tools he uses in kernel development that people can use. We've probably got about 20 minutes of a talk, 20, 25 minutes of a talk, which will leave us about 15 minutes for, I think, we may have just a general floor session. If people want to, you know, discuss certain tools they've used, they can just stand up and say a bit about tools they think are interesting or that other people might have an interest in, or, you know, just a bit of an open talking session. The second slot was TBD on the schedule. We filled it. It's deep hacking, though. We decided we'd give it one, you know, talk for the kernel hackers. So it's a scalable RMAP, I think, is Lee. It's scalable RMAP. Yes. So it's real hardcore VM talk. But we decided we'd better have one at least. Yeah, keep the hardcore people interested. In slot three, we've got a show and tell. I've got Daniel Stone, hopefully, if he has gotten over last night, turning up with a N800. So we'll have a, you know, look at the N800. Wow, it's nice and flashy. And we might have, if Ben has recovered and can find one, a PS3 to show. Others one there. Well, we can take that one there as well and show that one. So, and Ben will just give us a, you know, 5 minutes, what they've been doing with the PS3 Linux and bootloaders and stuff. But, Ben has now moved into doing graphical user interfaces with Keith Packard. It's scary. Then slot four, we're going to have a Lightning updates. So far, I think we've got like 5 updates, I think. So we've got 5 updates to that, but anyone is welcome to come up to myself or Willie at any time, you know, in the breaks and just suggest another one. Willie's keeping the list, hopefully. So we've got 40 minutes. We'll suitably size the talks to however long. We've decided, on advice from people yesterday, that probably best off if you don't have slides. You can bring your laptop up and have it to prompt yourself, but we don't want the hassle of plugging laptops in and out because it just took too much time with the things yesterday. Then slot five is hopefully where it should get a bit interesting. We've managed to arm wrestle a few of the kernel maintainers from various places into sitting down at a panel. So far, we're going to just have a few questions, but we'd like to get audience questions as much as possible. So, you know, any sort of interesting. The people we have on the panel at the moment are David Jones from Fedora, who's the kernel maintainer for Fedora's kernel. Andy Clean from SUSE, who's the x86 64-bit, and I think Linus made him the x86 maintainer, but I don't know if he's admitted it yet. I think Paul is going to do. Is Paul here? Yeah, so if Paul gets here in time, we'll have Paul Macaras from Oz Labs doing the PPC maintainer. If Paul doesn't get here, we'll have Ben. I sort of threw in Christoph Helwig as well, if he actually is alive at this stage, he'll come, because Christoph doesn't maintain much, but he's loud. So. and Dave Miller finally said yes, so we got Dave, who's the networking and Spark, or is it Spark and networking? I'm not sure which goes first, Dave. So that should be a pretty interesting discussion. Pretty much open floor. We'll have the usual stock questions like via Emacs, KDE or GNOME, you know, Compiz or Burl, the new one I have. So and finally in slot six, Matthew Garrett and myself will have a suspend to RAM workshop. This is possibly not going to be the best idea we've ever had. But we'll try our best. So Matthew's pretty much been doing the Ubuntu suspend, you know, laptop support for while now, and he seems to know more about it. So it really helps if you're running Ubuntu Edgy. You know, there's a really good chance it'll fix then. And with Xorg, we're usually blamed if it's not the kernel's fault. So I said, I'll stand up and hopefully see what drivers we've got problems with and where the issues are. So that's pretty much the whole day. If anyone, again, yeah, lightning talks are the main thing. We just need to get one or two more, I suppose, if people are interested. So we've got four.
Right, superphages, ELSA, per page shrinking of slab caches, and I'm going to talk about my recent work on PCI slots. So if anyone else wants to give a talk, come and see me.
So I suppose now I was meant to wait 15 minutes, but we'll let Peter start.
Hello, is that working now? Great. I'm with Gelato at UNSW. Our main job is to make Linux work better on Itanium. And as part of that job, I spend a lot of my time building kernels. When you start building a kernel, when you first come to the Linux kernel, it feels a bit like a Heath Robinson invention. You know, there's strings all over the place, and if you pull this string over here, something happens way over there. And it's looked after by this gang of rather strange people who seem to concentrate on the Linux kernel to the exclusion of almost anything else. And it's really intimidating to try to put your little patch in and get an email back from Linus saying, yes, I think you can do it. It's just amazing. And it really is a little bit like that. The Linux kernel is a huge, complex code base, and it's fairly hard to navigate because grep tends to pick up all these things in the architecture, specific bits that you're not really interested in, as well as the bits you are interested in. It's very easy when you're trying to change something over here to miss the usage of that variable over there, which means that the change you make over here would actually break something somewhere else. So you make a change that fixes Itanium and it breaks x86 and people are not very happy. Or you make a change, which is what I did very early on, to remove the initial NAND disk to disable the floppy part of the boot code if you haven't got config floppy turned on and accidentally break booting via a NAND disk. That one actually got into the kernel for about a week. And there are hundreds of architectures, well, dozens anyway. There's no way that you're going to have the hardware to test them all. So how are you going to get into kernel development? The other problem is that it takes a long time to compile. Because GCC isn't particularly good on Itanium, it's not because Itanium is slow. In fact, Itanium is quite fast. It takes about half an hour to build a kernel. All right? That I am talking about single CPU at this point. And that is because it has a huge code base, large memory requirements, especially for link time. And yeah, Also, it takes a long time to reboot. Every time you boot, it's got to go out and scan all those SCSI chains. And that's even before it gets to the bootloader, which means you can be 15 minutes between the time you push the reset button because things hung and the time you get to the eLILO prompt to say which kernel you want to boot. And then Linux goes and scans the SCSI chain again when it comes up. So it can take a very long time. And if you have to reboot twice to install a new kernel, once to get out of your current hung state and into a state where you can boot a known good kernel, and then again, after you've installed the known good kernel, to install your test kernel, it's just a pain. So let's try not to do it. So how do we manage all this? Firstly, there's a beautiful documentation directory. It's got lots and lots of stuff in it. Read it. Some of it isn't actually there yet. So the first thing you need to do is type make PDF docs and make man docs. And that will give you lots of useful stuff. Unfortunately, some of it's a bit out of date. Kernel maintainers prefer hacking code to writing documentation, which means that, for example, Rusty's totally unreliable guide to kernel hacking, which is in the PDF docs, is still referring to something in the 2.5 time frame rather than 2.6.20 this week. But anyway, it's still generally valid and worth looking at. Next thing you've got to do is become familiar with what the code base is. There's a number of different Linux cross-references out there on the web. We run one on the Gelato server, but there's a whole heap of others. If you just Google for LXR, you'll find dozens. Each of them has slightly different emphases. So you'll find one that's emphasizing the net dev branch of the Linux kernel. But there's quite a few that just have the basic kernel in all its architectures. So it's worth finding one that you're comfortable with, that's got a reasonably low latency to where you are, and using it. The best ones update fairly regularly. So although they won't be today's head of tree, they'll be within a few days. When you're actually developing, it's really useful to be able to find the definition of the things that you look there. So when you say C struct tar struct, can we actually find where the definition of it is so we can see what the variables are inside the structs, the fields, so we can work out what they all do. Tags is your friend there. And I'll give you an example as soon as I finish with this slide. Tags works really well with Emacs and Xemacs, if you're an Xemacs user or an Emacs user. There is a version of tags for Vi. It doesn't work quite as well, although I think they fixed that in Vim. But if you're using straight Vi, it doesn't work quite so well. It does work very well. Yeah, I thought it would do. I'm not a Vim user, so. Yeah. If you are using Vi or Vim, there's another tool, Cscope, which does an even better job than tags does. And I'm going to try and give you an example of that now, if I can. So first we'll go to user source, I can't spell, Linux 2.6. And you get all these things here. And somewhere down there, there's a file called tags. And I haven't made tags. Yep, there's a file called tags there. Up there in the middle. That contains an index of symbols. We'll just try and visit it. It's pretty big, and this is a slow laptop with only 256 mega memory, so it takes a long time. Looks a bit like this. What you'll see is there's the name of a file, a full path name from the top of the source tree, and then a set of definitions that are essentially regular expressions to be searched for. Are they? No. There's strings to be searched for plus a couple of line numbers where it can be found and the offsets within the line. That's more character offset and line number. So if we then try and find, we can then try and find a tag. I'm going to try struct, see where it comes to. And now you'll see the disadvantage of tags, because it will almost certainly not find the thing you wanted it to find. Yep, it finds a usage in the middle of hvcs.c. It's found something with the type instead of the actual struct. What I'd normally do to fix that is to go into the top-level makefile and rearrange the order of the files handed to eTags when the tags file's built, so that the architecture-specific include files and then the standard include files are included ahead of all the C source code. I've tried a couple of times to get that pushed upstream, but Sam Wallenberg doesn't seem to be very interested in it. But it would make tags much more useful. So you can get that patch off our website. You can, but it tends to be a really enormous list. Yeah. It tends to go for pages and pages and pages and not be very useful, particularly for something like that. But if you actually know where it is, which I do, the point is you tend to get used to where particular things are after you've been working with the kernel for a little while. And then you can go to it and there's the forward declaration. And down here somewhere is the actual definition. And then you can go through and find out all the bits you need. Okay, so that's that one. The other one is C-scope. I might make this a bit bigger for you. C-scope also builds a definition. I thought I had it in here. What's the magic? DP? Can you? Okay. Takes a little while to scan and build an enormous index of all the files that are in your directory and builds an index to all the symbols in those files. The nice thing about C-scope is you no longer have to use grep to find all the usages of a function. And it interacts really nicely with Vi. You just select the actual instance that you're interested in, and it will open Vi at that point, so you can just carry on going. And before I got onto Emacs, this was what I was using all the time. It's just that was 5 years ago, and I've forgotten how to do it. It takes a little while, so let's go back to the presentation in the meantime. It's a slow machine. Yum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum. No, it's a Pentium 3. C-scope lets you find all the usages of a function or a symbol. And that's a big advantage. Otherwise, you've got to use grep. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's really useful. It's worth mastering. Obviously, I haven't yet. Speeding decompilation. Well, you can either use a huge machine, a 64-way Superdome, a titanium box. You can compile in about 3 minutes, and most of that time is on the final link. But most of us can't afford that. So there's some other tricks to speeding it up. First, don't use NFS or Samba for your kernel source. Pardon? Yeah. And 1.5 minutes of that is the final link. GCC is slow. That's the bottom. Put your kernel source in your local disk. Try and get a minimal configuration that boots on your test machine. Only have the things you really, really need. Otherwise, you spend a lot of time compiling stuff that you don't really need. Use DCC and Ccache. I'll talk about those in a minute. They're just great tools. And if you've got to compile multiple different configurations, try using the O equals stuff on your make line so that you can keep the old versions of stuff around so that you only rebuild the stuff that's changed rather than other bits. The idea is that you can keep your binary files, the product of your make, in a separate directory from your source tree. And if you do that, then you can use a different source tree for a different destination tree for each configuration that you're trying to build for. And if you do that, then you can make a change, then rebuild for all your configurations, and you haven't lost all your stuff that you would otherwise be rebuilding because you've had to blow it away for a different configuration. Because everything depends on configuration. Or you can use my KBuild script that does all this stuff automatically for you. It's available from the Zada wiki. Okay, DistCC, what it does is it takes a compilation and tries to distribute it across a cluster of machines. Ccache works by running the CP processor over a C file, taking a hash of the result and putting that into an index, and saving the output of your compilation, your final compilation as well. And then next time you type make and CC, it just runs the CP processor again, gets the hash, looks it up in its index, and if it's the same, it just delivers you the .o that you've already compiled. So that can be much faster than building everything from scratch, because particularly in Titanium, the optimizer takes forever. Junior build machine, lots of memory. Mount slash tempus tempus makes it just a little bit faster. Actually, if you've got lots of memory, that's not so important. Use a fast disk. Compiling on my laptop with 5400 RPM disk takes a lot longer than on one of the Itanium boxes with a 320 SCSI thing. Try and use SMP. And use make-j some large number that's appropriate for your configurations. -j, by the way, on make, runs lots of makes in parallel. So you can speed things up. But lots of memory is especially important at link time. Because you've got a huge thing you're trying to link, and because you've got huge symbol tables, a lot of which is going to be thrown away in the final image, the linker uses lots and lots of memory. SMP is better than multicore for this kind of thing. For some reason, the multicore systems tend to share memory bandwidth to the individual cores, which means that a multicore processor will run slightly slower than two separate processors with an appropriately configured memory bus structure. There's a couple of caveats with this CC. Particularly if you're using a heterogeneous build environment. I mean, I'm building for Itanium, but out there as build machines which this CC runs on, we've got PowerPC, we've got x86, we've got x86-64. So you can't just say CC equals GCC. You've got to say CCC equals IS64-Linux-GCC-40. And that way it'll work on every machine there, not just on the local one. The other caveat is that Ccache can't see changes to the assembler. So if you're doing afterburning, which is the topic of my talk on Friday, plug, you can't really use Ccache, because if you change the afterburner, which changes the resulting code but doesn't change the CP process output, then Ccache can't see the change. Most of that is not going to be a problem to you people, because you don't change the tool chain that often. Speeding up booting. One, don't use modules. Do boot via DHCP. If you're booting via DHCP, you've got your kernel on a separate machine that your target machine can pick up via TFTP, then you only have to reboot once for each crash. You push the reset button, it then goes out, grabs the new kernel from the network, your new test kernel, installs it in your op. And that halves the time in the cycle between think, build, install, debug, crash, start again. And for all this kind of stuff, a serial console is extremely useful. The other thing you've really got to do is keep track of what you've done. It's because you've got a very large, complex system, you need to keep track of the changes you've made, otherwise you'll forget. There's some small problem over here, you do a one-liner to fix it, and then for some reason you decide to blow away your source tree and start again, and you've lost that change, you've forgotten what it was. If you use some kind of source code control mechanism, I don't care what it is, you can just roll back that change or incorporate it into your new tree or whatever. Because Linus uses Git, it's probably best if you want to run on head of tree to use either Git or Cogito. And that's really straightforward. You can just do CG clone. All the instructions are on the IC4 wiki. CG clone git colon slash slash git.kernel.org slash whatever. And it will create a copy of the tree in your thing. Nope. It's basically user interface stuff that's different. Mercurial is also pretty good. The Mercurial folk maintain a mirror of Linus's Git repository, so you can do almost exactly the same thing there. But then you've got the problem after that of how do you keep your changes separate from the changes that are coming down from upstream? And my answer to that is Qwilt. Qwilt's a little patch management tool that was originally written by Andrew Morton and has been taken on since then by the people at SUSE. What it does is it maintains a tree of patches that you can layer one on top of another. You can say which files you want to add to a patch and then go away and edit them. Then you say Qwilt refresh and you've got a patch. There's two advantages to that. One, your changes aren't in the Cogito repository or the Git repository with all of the other changes that are there. So you can see which ones are yours and which ones are somebody else's. And you can still update the upstream stuff underneath you and keep it separate. And secondly, because the output of the process is patches, it's already feeding off to the NetDev mailing list or the Linux kernel mailing list or whatever. So that's what I do. You've still got to do something about those patches and keep track of the changes to the patches. And for that, I keep the patches in CVS. It's perfectly adequate for a one-person project or a two-person project. More than that, you want something different, but still. And there are lots of other source code control systems as well. But I would say, use an SCM. Debugging. The magic system request key. Please install that on your systems. Configure that in. For things with a PS2 or a USB keyboard, you just type alt sys request and then some character. And different characters do different things. The useful things are you can get a trace of all the current running processes, so you can find out all the processes that are on the run queue and a backtrace of all of them. And sometimes you can see where one stopped because it's hung on a lock that someone else is holding. You can see what the memory statistics are. And a really useful one is U, which unmounts all the file systems and remounts them read-only. S, for syncing the file systems. You should do that before you remount them all read-only. And then B, which reboots the system. And that's a quick way to reboot without destroying your disk. Depends. Yeah, so you get corruption in the journal and kill everything. Kernel debuggers are useful. Keith Owens wrote the one that I use occasionally. Linus doesn't like them, so they never actually made it into the main kernel tree. But it's quite useful. And the so-called wolf fence debugging technique, which is where you stick print Ks before where you think your bug is and after, and see whether it actually gets there or not. Is the wolf inside the fence or not? Oh, move it again. Oh, I've crossed over. Yeah. So, very, very standard things. All these things are much more useful with a serial console. And maybe one day we'll have usable virtual machine debugging. So you can type GDB on your virtual machine and just use your standard user space tools on your kernel. And that would be neat too, because you could avoid all this hardware booting delay where it goes out and scans the SCSI disk, because with a virtual machine, that tends to be much, much shorter. If you want to get your changes useful, they've got to be given to somebody else. In order to get stuff upstream, the first thing is you've got to build some sort of street cred, be known. One way to do that is to keep submitting bug reports and keep pushing patches. Do read documentation coding style, and don't just read it, obey it. There's so many interesting patches that get sent upstream that are totally unapplicable because they don't conform to the current Linux kernel coding style. And do talk with the maintainers. Don't just send it into the ether on the Linux kernel mailing list. Work out who is the person who's responsible for the bit of the Linux kernel you're playing with, and send to that person as well. You might not get any further, but at least it's going to the person who is, at least in theory, responsible for that bit of the kernel. And unless you're working for a distro, work on Linus's kernel or Andrew Morton's kernel, not on the Debian patch kernel or the SUSE patch kernel or the Red Hat patch kernel, because the only people who care about the Red Hat patch kernel are the Red Hat maintainers, not the kernel maintainers, so it's not much point sending it to the wrong place. And now, you've got your Safari suit, you've got your pith helmet, go out and explore. Are there any questions? Yes, send a break. Any other questions? Ah, yeah, of course. You should have finished making now. Just type Cscope, and you get this menu here. You know, find the symbol, find the global definition, and so forth. Use tab to get to the right place. At least you used to. Where am I? I can't see where I am. Building the cross reference, that's why. That's right, yeah, yeah. I don't know why, I must have blown it away, but I had all this set up beforehand. I was running out of disk space and I've got a cron job that runs away and gets rid of stuff that's big. Pardon? Yeah, no, it doesn't get rid of that. Okay, I should say big and regenerable. You know the problem with live demos, they always go wrong. Yes? You can. There's no problem with developing on a virtual machine. The issue at the moment is that the debugging tools aren't quite there yet. For example, UML and my own Linux on Linux, they use a ptrace process to trap system calls. And if something else is ptracing your kernel, you can't use GDB on it because it also wants to use ptrace.
Well, it sort of depends whether you're doing the kernel part of the
first place. Yeah, there's not much point. Yeah. We almost finished? I can see my dislike hard on. must be thinking. Are there any other questions while we're waiting for this to go? There's one here? Oh. Okay. It's useful, well, for two reasons. Firstly, most of my machines are in a rack in a machine room which is locked. And well, you can, but there's no VGA screen on them anyway. And half of them are sort of on the other side of the world. So it's for that reason. But also, if you're running any kind of GUI, when the GUI crashes, you can't actually interact with the screen. So, you know, you're scruffed, you're stuffed. You can't use your magic system request key to find out what was going on. Or you can, but it's displaying to a different frame buffer from the one you've got displayed on your VGA. Also, I do a reasonable amount of embedded development where you don't have anything except a serial console. Yep.
Thank you.
machines, and they've almost always got a management console that you just plug an Ethernet cable into, and you can telnet to it, and that gives you a serial console. The only problem is they cost a lot more.
They do cost more, but it's dynamic anyway.
Yeah. Lots of time.
They must be cheap as well. I lost a little bit of next big thing on the hospital. Then one thing that every people using put here in meeting over and over again over the ad.
Yes. That'd be really neat.
We all have our hallucinations already mentioned, but I mean that's a useful thing to have. It gives you also the command for directly doing to add the from CMAC, but also has a period on it that they are doing.
I'm just going to try and find all the functions that call get net size. There's two of them. It just goes to two of them. And then you can select on the left hand side, you see there's a number, 01. You just type one of those, let's say one. And it opens via at exactly the right place so you can see where the usage is. Pretty neat. You don't have to use via for that. It uses whatever's in the visual environment variable, so you can set that to GNU client or something if you want to. Anybody else want to see it? He's got my boat Linux as well. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, but I wanted to show the raw one first. And I use the C-Scope mode on Emacs, but I haven't got it installed on this machine. Any other questions, comments? Are we having fun yet?
Yay.
Okay.